Welcome, this is week five of the ancient letter. If I doze off in the middle or stop making sense, let me know, please. Just before we start, just a reminder that next week we have the, not this Friday night, but next Friday night we have the Mindful Minyan, this time with a special candle lighting experience and meditation and so on. So we're working through the letter of the Ramban, the Nachmanides of the 13th century. Apologies again for last week missing. As you know, I was away in New York for the annual conference of Shluchim with 3,500 others. It was really, really amazing, I have to say. It was a good sharpening of the saw experience. And what I'm trying to do is, there was I probably could go on for hours about some of the stuff, but I'm going to try and share two stories today connected to what we're going to talk about, among many, many inspirational things that I took away. So before we do that, just let's review a little bit. We've been going through the various steps of the letter, and so far we've talked about those that are highlighted. We've talked about being open to growing, the idea of Shema Bini, his urging of his son to speak calmly, banishing anger, which he says is the root of all evil. And last week we talked about two of the steps, which is humility. He says that the banishing anger and speaking calmly leads to humility. And once a person is humble and can relate to other people, that also relates to what he calls Yirat Hashem, which is essentially a relationship with God, making God real and making space for God in our lives. We explained that humility is the concept of being present. In other words, humility is not about losing our identity, but it's being fully, fully present, but at the same time not taking up space. In other words, at the same time not giving ourselves that amount of credit, but understanding that we're part of a bigger reality, and therefore gives us the ability to make room for all other people. And that was hinted in the concept we talked about. Yeah, we did that last week. The two pieces of paper that Rabbunim of Simcha Bunim of Sishcha said that when I have two pieces of paper, the one that says I'm like dust, the one that says the world was created for me, and they're complementary and not contradictory, because on the contrary, when we understand that we're nothing, but that nothing is part of the bigger reality, it gives us a bigger responsibility to contribute to the overall mission and purpose and meaning of life. And we also, I just want to repeat that, because this was a beautiful saying, that humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's about thinking of yourself less, which I thought was a very, very beautiful saying. So let's now go on to the next step that he says. This is what Nachmanides continues to write in his letter, and he says the following. He says, once you have acquired these fine qualities, meaning talking calmly, banishing anger, humility, you will indeed be happy with your lot. Now, that's what he says. I want to explore this, because on a simple level, what he's saying is a very simple idea. And in fact, this concept of being happy with your lot is a quote, really. It's a quote from Pirkei Avot. It's a quote from the Ethics of the Fathers, where the Ethics of the Fathers tells us who is truly wealthy. That's what we are told. Who is a truly wealthy person? Hasameach bechelko. And that's normally translated as one who is satisfied with his lot. Right? And that's what Nachmanides is referring to when he says that if you reach these qualities, you'll be able to be satisfied with your lot, or happy with your lot, because although the Pirkei Avot tells us that who is a truly wealthy person, someone who's satisfied with what they have, it doesn't actually tell us how to get there. So Nachmanides is telling us on a very simple level that all of the things he's talked about, when someone is less anxious and less stressed and less agitated, when someone feels less of a sense of entitlement, he's calm with other people, he achieves a certain sense of tranquility and inner peace. His relationships with other people are solid, and he makes room for others and doesn't expect things to go their way all the time. Together with that sense of humility that we spoke about last week, of course, that will bring a person not to be so entitled, not to expect that much for themselves, and to be happy or satisfied with what they have. So that's on a very simple level. However, I want to take it to a much, much deeper level today, because if you look at that saying of Pirkei Avot, It's always mistranslated, actually, if you think about it carefully. Because what it says is, Ezeu Ashir, who is a wealthy person, Hasameach Bechelko. The word Sameach to mean is happy. And it's always translated as one who is satisfied with his lot. It doesn't say one who is satisfied. It says one who is Sameach, one who is happy with his or her lot, right? In other words, it's not just about being satisfied with what we have. It's actually much more than that. What the Pirkei Avot is expecting from us, what the Ethics of the Fathers is telling us, and the Ramban Nachmanides is hinting to it, it's not enough to be satisfied with what we have. What we need to do is much more than that. We need to bring joy in everything that we have. It's a big difference. There's about being satisfied, I'm okay, I know I don't have what I need, but I'm fine, or I don't have as much as I would like to, but I'm okay. But it's much more than that. First of all, when we talk about being satisfied with our lot, it's not just physical things, it's also about about every experience that we have. And what we are telling, what he's telling us is this, he's explaining to us this concept of simcha, the concept of joy, bringing joy into everything that we have, bringing joy into every experience of life. So it's more than just being happy with, more than just being satisfied with what we have. It's about bringing joy and experiencing simcha, hasameach, experiencing true joy in every part of who we are. So let's understand. In order to understand that, we have to develop this a bit. And the first thing we need to do is revisit, which we've done many times before, but let's revisit the concept of happiness. Look at it a bit differently in the context of today's discussion. And one thing I want to explore specifically is the connection between humility and happiness. Because when people see the words humility and happiness, not always the imagery of those two words go together. It's not something maybe you would naturally put together. We think of happiness, we think of a person being very upbeat, very out there, very open. Humility sometimes has the imagery, although hopefully not after last week's discussion, but of being more withdrawn, more sort of low-key. And yet, there's a verse in the Psalms which tell us that it's specifically humility that is a critical ingredient of happiness. And we need to explore what that means, and this is what Nachmanides is saying. He's saying if you explore and engage in the things that I've talked to you about, speaking calmly, not getting angry, and eventually achieving the level of humility, you will be able to engage in joy. Bring joy into everything that you have. So what does that mean? So first of all, let's just take this slowly and develop the concept of simcha, the concept of happiness. So we know that in Jewish literature, there's a tremendous emphasis on joy. In fact, King David tells us, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serve God with joy. And the commentaries explain that if a person is commanded to serve God with joy, what that really means is that we're commanded to try and achieve a sense of joy and happiness in everything that we do. Because ultimately our whole life should revolve around divine service, which means everything we do, whether spiritual or physical, whether holy or mundane, should be part of our overall life mission and overall sort of purpose and journey of making the world a better place and bringing holiness and godliness and serving God and so on and so forth. And therefore, Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, serving God with joy, means to achieve a permanent state of joy, which already gives us a little bit of an insight that joy doesn't always mean a full expression of joy, being happy and dancing and singing and so on and so forth. Joy is a state of mind, as we'll soon discover and we'll soon develop. But never, having said that, there is a tremendous emphasis in Jewish literature in trying to achieve a state of happiness. We are taught that happiness brings growth. When a person feels joyous, when a person feels happy, they're able to be more open. You know, it's a Yiddish word, but for those that understand it a little bit, I'll explain it. You know, they say that a person who's sad is always verkvetched. You know, verkvetched means always like, I don't know how you translate verkvetched. Something like that. That's different dialect of Yiddish. But person's fakesh means always squeezed, always limited, inhibited. Right? A person who is happy is not fakesh. The person who is happy is open, able to grow. When a person is happy, they're in a better mood, they're able to achieve things like giving, forgiveness, openness to new ideas. They're just more open. We have a Talmudic expression that says, Simcha poretz geder, which means joy breaks boundaries. Right? When a person is in a true state of happiness, they kind of are able or willing to achieve things or to try things and to explore things that maybe normally they'd be more inhibited to do, kind of thing. The Talmud, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but the Talmud says there was a story of a great Talmudic sage called Rabbah. And he had a thing, whenever he would give a very intense Talmudic lecture to his students, he'd always start with a joke. Why? Get people to laugh. And we know this today, it's even documented scientifically that laughter, they call laughter therapy today, right? So that when people would laugh, the students would laugh, they become more open, because he was worried that he's going to tell them and teach them new ideas, things they have to work hard to be open to absorb, maybe different ways of thinking that they weren't used to before. So in order to open up their minds, he'd let them relax. It wasn't just a public speaking strategy, it was more of a real thing of getting them to open up their minds, to be more open to new concepts and new ideas, so they would always start the shiur that way. Simcha, happiness, brings extra strength, inner strength. There's a very interesting story from a great Hasidic rabbi called Reb Simcha Bunim Psishra. I mentioned him last week. And he says that the story goes like this, he was once crossing a bridge and he noticed a person really battling in the water and he was about to drown. And he was powerless. He couldn't jump in. He couldn't help him. And he noticed a plank next to the person. And he noticed that the person is floundering and not able to do it. And he realized it's a matter of minutes and the person's going to simply drown. So he calls out to him and he says, "My friend, when you get down there, give my regards to the Leviosa, the Leviathan." The Leviathan is this Kabbalistic big fish that God created. It was a joke. So the guy started to laugh. And as he was able to laugh, he suddenly realized there's a plank next to him, and he grabbed the plank, and eventually he was saved. So Reb Simcha Bunim met up with him, and he explained to him, and he said, "When I saw you about to drown, I realized the reason that you were about to drown is that you were scared. And because you were scared, you were paralyzed. And although there was a plank there, you just needed a bit of koyach, a bit of strength to grab onto it. And I needed to save you, and I was not able to do anything, so I decided the only way to do it is to get you to laugh." So he sent him this joke. He said, "When you get down there, give my regards to that big fish." And you laughed and you got the strength. You let go of your fear a bit, right? So that's what simcha does. Joy has those properties that allows us to grow, allows us to be more open, allows us to do things that we weren't able to do before. But one important thing to understand is this. When we talk about happiness, there's two things. There's an expression of happiness, a manifestation of happiness. And then there's the source of happiness. Right. So for example, we talk about the expression of happiness or the manifestation of happiness, things like laughter, dancing, being together with people, right? But what we have to understand is that the expression of happiness is not always in line with the source of happiness. Meaning, not everyone that laughs is truly happy. Not everyone that dances is truly happy. Right? You know, sometimes people laugh when they're frightened or ashamed or don't know how to react, so people start to laugh, right? I'm sure you've noticed that. Why? Because actually it comes from a sense of hopelessness, meaningless. Sometimes people are engaged in what appears to be a happy type of occasion and really they're not really happy. I've told you this experience of walking down Oxford Street one night in the middle of, from the hospital in the middle of the night. It was Yontif and my son was there. And it hit me, this concept, when I saw people partying in a bar and came closer. I wish I wouldn't have, because it was a bit scary, but right, but I had to, there's no other way to get home. It was an emergency, we had to take him. My wife and I were walking down Oxford Street and suddenly they broke into this angry fight and they were fighting, I had to call the police. It was unbelievable. What was supposed to be a party was not happy at all, because not every time people party are they happy. Not every time people engage in activities which should be connected to happiness, are they really happy? Right. Sometimes laughter is cynical. It could be a cynical laugh. Sometimes partying is just an obsession with pleasure. It's nothing to do with happiness. Why? Because when we talk about happiness or the expression of happiness, which is a good thing, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, used to emphasize the concept of singing and dancing, and there was a tremendous role for that in his whole teachings. But it was only if it came as a result of the source of happiness. In other words, you don't become happy by just dancing or laughing. You become happy with dancing and laughing in line with a inner sense of happiness, with a true source of happiness. And we need to explore, what is that source of happiness? What does that mean? What does it mean to be truly happy? So as we spoke about many, many times, and I want to just start with this and we go into this, that there's a big, big difference between happiness and pleasure. Right? And that's often, often confused. Now, as I always say, there's nothing wrong with pleasure. Nothing wrong with doing things that are comfortable. Nothing wrong with doing things that we enjoy. What is wrong is two things. It's excess and using it as a substitute for happiness. That's wrong. Excessive pursuit of pleasure doesn't bring happiness. And using pleasure as a substitute for happiness certainly doesn't bring happiness. On the contrary, it actually brings more tension. And the big difference between pleasure and happiness, as we've spoken about many times, is this. Pleasure is an outside-in model. It's bringing in something from the outside into my existence for the purpose of me feeling good and hopefully achieving happiness. But it doesn't achieve happiness, because what happens is it's extremely transient, it doesn't last for a long time, and it doesn't bring happiness. In fact, there are research studies today which tell us that after a person has their basic needs, this was a research study done in the States, that once a person has their basic living needs, there's absolutely no correlation between how much a person has and happiness. Nothing. Now, that doesn't mean people shouldn't have abundant blessings. We pray that God should bless every person with tremendous blessings. But that's not going to bring happiness. It'll bring convenience. It'll bring pleasure on a certain level. Great opportunities sometimes. But it doesn't bring happiness. No correlation between the sources of pleasure and the sources of things that I have and the concept of happiness. Because simcha, happiness, is the opposite. Happiness is an inside-out model. Happiness is a feeling of inner fulfillment and inner contentment, which can only come from within. It can only come from an inner sense of meaning and purpose. In fact, probably the best definition of happiness is, real happiness, is the ability to give meaning and purpose to every life experience. Now, let's try and understand that. So I'm going to explain this to you using a Kabbalistic model of three great people in Chumash, in the beginning of the Torah story. Chava, Eve, Noah with the flood, and Sarah, matriarch Sarah, who we just read about a few weeks ago. And this is a comment from the Zohar, the great Kabbalistic work, the Zohar, who says the following, and it's a comment on Sarah, actually. And let me just explain this to you so we have it clear. When Sarah passed away, it says that Sarah lived, the life of Sarah was 100 years, 20 years, and 7 years. In other words, she lived for 127 years. And the commentaries all battle with why it has to be divided up that way. 100 years, 20 years, 7 years. Why don't you just say 127 years? Right? And the commentaries explain that when she was 100, she was like 20. When she was 20, she was like 7. Which means, as Rashi points out, Kulan Shavin Letova. All of Sarah's years were equally good. That's what it says. Were equally good. They were all equal. When she was 100, it was like she was 20. When she was 20, she was like 7. They were all good. Which is a puzzling comment in its own, because Sarah's years were not all good. And they were not all the same. There were good years and there were tough years. There were years of childlessness. There was years of being captured in Egypt by the Pharaoh. She was kidnapped. There were challenging times. Sarah and Abraham went through lots of challenging times. So what does it actually mean that kulan shavin letova, that they're all equally good? And what does it mean they're all consistent? They weren't. So the Zohar makes the following comment. The Zohar says that Sarah merited to a very high level of life because she fixed, she was able to achieve what Eve and Noah weren't able to achieve. Now, what's the connection between these three people? So this is how the explanation goes. We all know that Eve, the day she was created, Adam and Eve, did what they weren't supposed to do, and they ate from the forbidden fruit. Right? That's a story with Eve. Noah, there was a story. I don't know if you know, it's a detail in the story of the flood. But after the flood finished, it says that Noah planted, he had to plant, replant a lot of the trees. He planted a vineyard. He grew grapes. I mean, it didn't happen in 5 minutes, obviously, but over time, he planted a vineyard, he grew grapes. From the grapes, he made very good wine. He drank the wine in excess and became drunk. He became intoxicated. He lay down in his tent and didn't have such good consequences. That's what the Zohar says. Came along Sarah, she did it right. What's the connection? So the Kabbalists explain the following day. Is it very hot in this room? It is, right? No? You're okay? Can you put on the air conditioner for a few minutes? Is that okay? Can you just press the air conditioner? Thanks. Just a little bit, yeah, maybe for 10 minutes. Okay. So this is how the Kabbalists explain this. It's a deep idea. Let me try and get it clear. All three of those great people wanted to, because knowing and being conscious of the importance of happiness and simcha and joy, they wanted to engage in the concept of simcha. So what does Chava do? What does Eve do? She confuses happiness with pleasure. It's an age-old problem. She sees the fruit. She understands the importance of joy. She knows that grapes ultimately is going to be a source of joy. It says wine makes people happy. If used in the right way, it can make them truly happy. She does it prematurely. She does it when she wasn't supposed to do it. She confuses happiness with pleasure. She takes something that was delicious looking and eats it, feeds it to her husband, Adam. They both eat it. They both engage in this pleasurable activity with the purpose and the intention of achieving joy. And they weren't able to do that. And they mixed up the whole concept of joy and pleasure. Because why? Because pleasure, one of the differences between pleasure and joy is, pleasure is about me. Joy is actually about other people. That's why when people are truly happy, their relationships are better. They give to other people. It's about growth. It's about going beyond myself. It's about finding meaning and purpose in the things around me, in the people around me, in experiences around me. So therefore, what Sarah did, what Chava did, what Eve did, the Kabbalists explain is that she was focused on herself. Pleasure is a self-serving thing. Now again, a bit of pleasure is okay, but the substitute between pleasure and happiness is a problematic experience. So Eve, takes the fruit, confusing joy with pleasure, feels good, tastes good, enjoys the experience, but doesn't achieve joy, and messes up. Comes along Noah, and Noah says, you know, I've got to fix this. So what does he do? He does exactly the opposite. He says, if that's the case, if joy is not about me, so I'm going to lose myself. I'm going to escape. I'm going to totally negate my existence. It wasn't just that he got drunk. That wasn't the point. He getting drunk was actually well-intentioned. He thought that's the way you achieve joy, by getting yourself out of the way. So he drinks in excess, gets himself out of the way, and doesn't achieve joy. Why not? Because to achieve joy, says the Zohar, you have to be like Sarah. Because to achieve joy, you've got to be like we spoke last week with regard to humility. Because to achieve joy, joy means you, self-negation is not about escaping. It's not about getting yourself out the picture. It's about being fully present and yet making space. It's about being fully present and with that presence finding meaning and purpose rather than being self-serving. It's about being fully present and trying to help others and give to others and experience an inner sense of fulfillment when you're present, not when you're not there. To be happy, to achieve happiness, happiness is something where you have to be there. You can't feel happy if you're not there. Noach just disappeared. He escaped. He got drunk, took himself out of the picture. That doesn't achieve joy. That's the opposite of what Eve did, but doesn't achieve joy either. Sarah was able to achieve joy. Why? Because here comes back to the concept of humility and joy. See, we explained last week that humility means that you're fully, fully present. You've got the one piece of paper that says the world was created for me. You're there because God gave you talents. He gave you capabilities. He gave you potential. He gave you a brain. He gave you a heart. He gave you abilities. But it's not self-serving. It's about using those capabilities, about using those abilities to help others, to give, to bring meaning and purpose into life, to be part of the overall divine plan, to understand that we're just a small piece in a huge puzzle. That's what true humility is. And that is why the Tehillim says, King David says, that humility brings joy. Because when you're humble, number one, you don't disappear. But on the other hand, when you're humble, any experience that you have, even when it's painful or even when it's challenging, and even when we do feel the pain and do feel the challenge, which we should do, we've talked about this many times, we're human and God gave us emotions, and we suppose part of being present is to endure and feel the challenge. But yet, our conclusion always is that it's not about me. It's about what can I give, how can I give meaning and purpose to this experience? How can I make room for others? How can I incorporate others? How can I be less focused on myself and more focused on the plan, more focused on the mission, more focused on the purpose, more focused on other people? How can I make a difference? It's not about me at the end of the day. It's about me being here. It's about me contributing. But if I want to find real meaning and real purpose, it's about using whatever I have not to be focused on myself, but rather to be inside out, focused on growth, focused on others, focused on making room. Am I making sense? Yeah? I'm very jet lagged, so I'm just worried. Okay. You see, seeking pleasure is very different. Seeking pleasure means when we focus on seeking pleasure, then the focus is on us. When there's an obsession in trying to achieve happiness by achieving things and by enjoying things, then the focus is on me. When the focus is on me, it's never enough. All that does is it builds entitlement. It builds a sense of self. It builds a focus on self. It locks us out from other people. It makes us grow. So that we go back to the story I told you last week about the guy that asked at Tzemach Tzedek, the great Hasidic rabbi, why is everyone trampling on me? He says, don't spread yourself so all over the place. They won't trample on you. That comes from a sense of self. Seeking pleasure, being obsessed with material pursuit and pleasure pursuit brings that. That's the result. That's the opposite of humility. Humility means, as we explained last week, like Sarah. Sarah was the true humble person, and that's why she found true joy, says the Zohar. Why? She didn't have an easy life all the time. Some of it was great, some of it wasn't. But it wasn't about her. And therefore, Kulan Shavin Latova, all her years were equal, says the Zohar, because whatever she experienced, she said, how can I give this meaning and purpose? How can I find meaning in this experience? How can I be content? How can I find an inner contentment? Notwithstanding that this particular part of the journey might be more painful than some of the other parts. And that's the relationship between joy and humility. When we less focus on ourselves and we're more focused on the bigger picture and making space for others through the concept of humility, by understanding that God is this infinite power that we are part of, and that He created us, and that's part of the divine plan, as we explained at length last two weeks ago, then we less focus on our needs and more focused on about what we can do with the experience. And when we focus on what we can do with the experience, we are able to achieve and reach a level of joy, a level of true happiness, inner fulfillment. And that's why We know that humility, that joy often comes from giving. Sharing with others and giving and connecting to other people, even when it's difficult. See, that's what people don't understand often, that joy doesn't mean that it's not associated with pain. Sometimes on the contrary, you've got to go out of your comfort zone to achieve real joy. You've got to give to others to achieve real joy, because that's what brings meaning and purpose. And that's why giving to others, helping others, inspiring others, connecting to others is what is synonymous and truly brings the concept of joy. And connecting to others and giving to others also needs, if it's true giving, it needs a sense of humility as well, because it's about making space for other people. So although it's not completely directed with the topic, but I want to share with you two stories that I heard on among the many, many stories that I heard on Sunday night. So just to explain to you the context, so this conference that I went to is a yearly conference of Chabad rabbis all over the world, from what's now 100 countries. They just established the presence in the 100th country. There's now a guy going to Uganda. No, seriously. One of the most amazing, inspiring things about being there, seeing all these people that go to the most craziest of places, completely selflessly, because I'm not going to get any honor or glory or headline news from it. It's nothing. It's completely selfless, just to help others and inspire others. The most amazing thing. So I want to just tell you one story, first of all. So there were different stories that came out, and was one particular guy that spoke. This is the first story. Because I tell you the story because there was this tremendously powerful energy. So the conference goes for about 4 days. Workshops, ideas sharing, fabrangans, that's very, very powerful. And it culminates with this tremendous banquet that they have, where they join with about another couple of thousand guests, about 6,000 people in the room. It's the most amazing, amazing thing. And people, most of whom you don't know. I mean, it's not like, I mean, I know a lot of people there, and I caught up with a lot of friends I haven't seen for many years and stuff, but they're people that all over the place. And it's very, very, very powerful. And there's a tremendous sense of purpose and focus and joy, like real, real joy. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking that it's not just joy from nothing. It's joy that's coming from this kind of stuff. It's a joy that's coming from a focus, a mission, and the concept of giving and helping others. And I want to just share with you two stories. So one story, a guy got up and spoke. His name is Rabbi Yonason Abrams. And he's in a place which I can't even pronounce in California called Temecula, California. I pronounce California. I just don't know how to pronounce the name. I think it's Temecula or something like that. Temecula. And he told the following story, that there was a boy who was 8 years old, 21 years ago, who, on the first night of Shmini Atzeret, which is a day and a half before Simchat Torah, was walking with his father from Shul. And he said to his father, you know, it would be really, really nice if on Simchat Torah, the Torah scroll from Shul can come to our house. So his father said to him, what do you mean? Like, you don't take Torah scrolls from Shul to the homes. But his father knew why he was asking, because unfortunately this boy's mother, this person's wife, was very, very unwell. She was busy going through treatment, and she wasn't able to go to shul. She was very, very weak. So although the father told the boy that it's not possible, he must have shared this thought with the rabbi of the shul. And on Simchat Torah day, this woman was sitting on the porch and just recovering from the effects of chemo, and it was just very, very, very painful. And suddenly she hears singing. And the entire shul is on the way with the Torah, with the whole thing. She sees her son, the little 9-year-old, 8-year-old boy, on the shoulders of one of the Shiva students. The rabbi was there, the father was there, the women were there, everyone was there, everyone came, and they did one hakafah, one dancing for this boy's mother. He tells the story because the woman was his mother and he was the boy. He tells the story because this set in chain a whole motion of things. So unfortunately the story had a very, very sad ending, and she passed away a few months later. But his inspiration from his request as a young boy being fulfilled by the rabbi, who happened to be the Rabbi Yonah Fratkin of Chabad of San Diego, who had this feeling just to come. So he just was very, very affected by it, and he kind of said, this is the people I want to sort of hang around with, and this is the path I'm going to try and sort of follow. And then just then, a couple of months later, a Chabad rabbi moved into a neighboring place, this Temecula, California. And this young boy, who was an orphan then, he somehow connected up with his family and became very, very close to this couple, Rabbi Yitzi and Dina Horowitz. Some of you might have actually known the name. I'll tell you why in a second. And he became like a son to them. Now, you have to know who this Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz is. Unfortunately, a few years ago, this Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz was diagnosed with ALS. And right now, he actually is unable to do anything except for his eyes. His only thing that works are his eyes. He's constantly in a bed, and it's amazing technology, thank God we have today at least, that he's able to operate a computer with eye movements. He writes a weekly Torah thought. He's surrounded with friends and family, and he's got the most amazing sparkle and twinkle in his eyes. Something beyond understanding. He's got this inner sense of happiness that we're talking about now, which is, despite the fact that he's completely paralyzed, cannot do a thing. But as the illness started to progress, he asked this guy to come and take over from him in Temecula. So he had to move to Los Angeles. So the whole story came around, and he was standing there. And I'll just try to share with you the moment, because he ended up by saying that right now Rabbi Yitzi Horowitz was actually watching. It was live. And he was in his bed, and he was watching the thing, and the whole place just got up. It was like the most amazing moment, that he wished him, you know, a recovery and blessing and his family blessing, and just standing over, everyone just got up, the whole room. No one even knows the guy. I mean, not, I never knew this person until now. And it was just an amazing, amazing sense. Based on what? Nothing to do with pleasure. Based on giving. It was based on one person helping another, helping another, helping another. He was an 8-year-old boy. The rabbi came and brought the whole shul to his thing. He joined up with Rabbi Horowitz, who came there to help other people. He then became a son to him. He took over from him. And that's where the chain continues. Just an amazing, amazing experience. That was one story. The other story I want to share with you is about a rabbi in Ghana. Do you know where Ghana is? Because I didn't actually until I don't know what he was there. Even though I'm from Africa, but I should have known where it is. I was never good in geography, it's called. But one of the side benefits of going to this convention is you learn a lot of things you didn't know. I'm talking about regular things, you know, just general knowledge, like geography. Never heard of some of these places. Okay. Now, let me give you the background to this story. This is also an amazing story. I'm going to play you a little clip. So, in 1961, President Kennedy announced a new project called the Peace Corps. Right? I also looked up, by the way, why it's spelled corpse and it's pronounced corps. Do you know that? Yeah, I was bothered by why everyone's saying Peace Corps and it's corpse. Right? So I looked it up. Okay, so what was the idea of this Peace Corps? The idea of the Peace Corps was to gather a pool of very trained men and women who would be sent to the far-flung areas of the world. And the idea was to help foreign countries meet their needs, impoverished people in need, and so on and so forth. Right? And it would be a response to have a need for skilled manpower, and they would send people all over. So he announced this the 1st of March, 1961, which was corresponded, happened to be with the 13th of Adar, the Hebrew month of Adar, which is day before Purim. The next day, the 2nd of March, which was the 14th of Adar, on Purim, the Lubavitch Rebbe had a big Fabrengen, as he always used to do on Purim. And 1961 was about 11 years after he became the Rebbe, after he assumed leadership. And when the Rebbe assumed leadership, this is one of his missions, he says, we're going to make the world a better place, we're going to prepare the world for Mashiach. And he started this whole process of sending people out, which was in the first few years was very, very foreign. People were very hesitant, and it was a slow start. So the next day at the Fabrengen, in the spirit of what the Baal Shem Tov teaches, that from everything you have to learn a lesson, the Rebbe spoke about this piece of news that he had read in the newspaper. And he said, and there's a recorded thing of it, he says that yesterday the president of this particular country announced this Peace Corps about sending people to far flung of the world, and there was an amazing response, and we have to learn from it. And then he started to actually be a bit sharp about it, and he said, the world needs people to spread holiness, to spread Yiddishkeit, to spread Judaism, Jewish identity, and so on and so forth, And why is it going so slow? If the president of the United States is a non-Jewish president, non-Jewish community can do this, and people are responding, where are my soldiers? He doesn't say those words, but more or less, right? And that was a big, big shift in the whole what we call the shlichut concept of sending people all over the world. And really over the next number of decades, and particularly the last 20, 30 years, it just exploded, right? So in August 1961 was the first mission to Ghana, from the Peace Corps. Okay. Happens to be that August 20, 2015 was when the first Chabad rabbi went to Ghana. So there's a Chabad rabbi in Ghana now. His name is Rabbi Majeski. I've met him before. He doesn't know. I don't know him well. And he spoke about life in Ghana. So he's there, obviously. I don't know if you know about Ghana, but it's the most primitive place. Mm-hmm. Right? Incidentally, I'll just parenthetically tell you a quick story I heard also about from in a different session from a guy who's the rabbi in a small town. I forgot the name of the town, but it's a Ukrainian town on the Russian border. It's a rabbi who comes from California. So initially when he applied, they wouldn't give him a visa. You know, because Ukraine and Russia are very tense with each other. This is on the Russian border, it's the Ukrainian city. Why wouldn't they give him a visa? Because they said like this, that someone who wants to leave, it's also a very, very primitive town, but they said someone who wants to leave the comfort of California and go to this particular town is one of two things. Either he's a spy or he's crazy. And we don't give visas to spies or crazies. So that's talking into it. No, he's not crazy. Anyway, so he also tells a story. He said when he came to the airport to go to Ghana, the guy looks at his passport, his ticket, he says, "You're not really going to Ghana, are you? I mean, like, why would you go to Ghana?" So, you know, he realized, obviously, you only go to Ghana if you have a mission, if you've got a purpose. Obviously, there's a business people there, there's Peace Corps people there, and there's people there. So, it's a short pictures. I mean, the place is, like, unbelievable. And he's there all alone with his kids, but he's built up a little shul, and he's got a Chabad center there. It's the most amazing thing. So, one day, so this was August 2015. One day, he's going shopping for Shabbos, and there's an American shopping mall there. So he's going to a place called ShopRite, which is an American store. And he sees a guy looking at him. So the guy says to him, an American guy says to him, "Are you a rabbi?" He's a funny guy, this rabbi. He says, "No, I just like to dress like this." Anyway, they got talking, and the guy says, this was a guy, his name was Andy Weissman. He had no connection to Judaism whatsoever. Grew up in America, completely secular, not interested in Yiddish guy one bit. And he gets talking to this guy, and eventually he makes it over to the rabbi Shul, and he got up then to tell the rest of the story, which I'm going to play for you. Oops, sorry. Let's go back in. Oh. Sorry, one second. Let's try this again.
Oh. Please welcome Andy Weissler.
Sorry. Oh, Weissler. Sorry, wrong on that.
I often joke with Rabbi Majeski that I have an advantage over him. You see, as of today, I've still spent more time in Ghana. My name is Andy Weissler, and on June 2nd, 2014, I have arrived in Ghana to start my Peace Corps service. For 3 years, I helped people who are living under impoverished conditions work to improve their lives. I lived with them, worked with them, taught them, and encouraged them. The day I met Rabbi Majeski changed my life forever. I come from a very secular home, and Judaism was not a central focus of my life. When I arrived in Africa, Judaism was not exactly on my mind. One fateful day, I met the rabbi, and the rest, as they say, is history. Through Shabbat dinners, weekly Torah classes, and morning minyan, I became in touch with my Jewish identity. The first time I was called to the Torah was in Chabad of Ghana. That same day I put on tefillin for the first time. And now I have my own set and I rap almost every day. Looking around this room and beholding the 3,000 Chabad rabbis, I'm fully aware that this story, here in Crown Heights.
Okay, so yeah, it was very, very powerful. I just wanted to show you a couple of stories when we think about it. The reason why I chose those stories is because, like, I know about Majeski and I saw him speak and I've met some of these people. They don't have much. I mean, they're living in Ghana. Can't be a picnic, I imagine. I know this from my own brothers-in-law who live in these remote areas in Chico and in Ashland and all these kind of places. But there's an incredible sense of happiness, an incredible sense of inner fulfillment. And I think it all has to do with this concept we've been talking about today, that happiness doesn't come from what you have. Happiness comes from a focus, from a giving, from a mission, whether it's Peace Corps on a sort of worldwide sort of scale, or it's Jewishly, that concept of helping other people. It doesn't have to be in Ghana. It can be right here in Sydney. It can be making a telephone call to someone else. It can be making space for other people. It can be helping someone who you know is falling through the cracks. It can be whatever it is. But when there's humility, and when we focus less on ourselves and more on making space for others, that's what Nachmanides says in the letter brings true joy. And I want to just end off because let's go back to this concept of serving God with joy. So the verse says, serve God besimcha, with joy, right? So fascinatingly enough, the word besimcha is the same letters as machshava, thought. Why is that? Because what does it mean to always be with joy and to serve God with joy? We know we don't always have, not everything is so beautiful all the time, right? We have our ups, we have our downs. Sometimes we're down, sometimes we're stressed, sometimes we're upset. And it's there that we need to change our mindset. It's there we need the machshava, the thought. It's about how we view ourselves. It's how we view the whole concept of happiness. It's about the concept and the decision, the choice that we make, whether we're going to be outside in or inside out. If it's outside in and it's about bringing things to serve me, the pleasure formula, then especially when things don't go our way, when we don't meet our expectations, we have the opposite of joy. We're sad, we're stressed, we're depressed. But if our machshava, if our thought process is able to turn around, and I say we're able to apply those things Nachmanides spoke about always talking calmly, being respectful to others, having a sense of humility. Humility bringing the concept of giving and making space and helping others and about a life of meaning and purpose. Then that machshava brings the same letters, which is besimcha, to serve God with joy. And that's the meaning of true joy. And that's why Nachmanides says that if you apply the teachings that I've been telling you, you're able to reach that true concept of joy. Joy meaning that inner sense of fulfillment and meaning and purpose. There are a few more steps to the letter. We have another 2 weeks, incidentally, to this series until we end the year. So we'll have a look at the final steps over the next 2 weeks. Have a great week.
Thank you.